It's Wednesday, May 5th, 2010, and you're listening to episode 190 of Fear the Boot, a show about tabletop role-playing games and a little bit more. Running time for this episode is 59 minutes. Welcome to Fear the Boot. My name is Dan.
My name's Chad.
This is Wayne.
My name's Pat.
And I'm Johan.
Johan, if you guys will remember, is in fact a motherfucker, as we were taught
right.
At the...
What you say?
What
I'm talking about,
say?
Johan!
Watch your mouth, boy. Now I can dig it. Johan was the guy who won the Fear the Con 3 trivia contest. And part of the prize was a chance to appear with us on Fear the Boot. The other part of the prize was you requested a copy of Descent. And I'm curious if you've actually played the game or not.
Yes, I have. In fact, I've played it several times. We've played it as a family now. Myself, my wife, and my children, including my four-year-old, who last time we played was the Overlord.
Nice.
And won.
Wow.
He might have had a little bit
your
of help.
Your four-year-old kicked your ass.
He might have had a little bit of help.
I just think he's starting him out right.
But he definitely whooped on the heroes, and they did not defeat the giants whose name I can't remember.
Awesome.
He's starting him out right. I mean, have you got Sky playing Arkham Horror yet?
I have Sky watching Doctor Who.
That is true.
He says, Daddy, I want to watch the police box. And we have to watch Doctor Who. I mean, it's...
All right, I got to give you props, but I'm not giving Pat any props since this kid still doesn't have Batman shoes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, they're so hard to find, like I said before. For whatever reason, we're in a downturn for Batman shoes. Right now, it's all Iron Man, all Spider-Man. I have tried to find them in there. The ones you can find are like the little Crocs or these little sandal things that I don't really care for. I want an honest-to-God pair of...
Just
Batman
like a pump, like a shoe.
Like a tennis shoe, tennis with a Velcro strap on or whatever that, you know, mm-hmm. kids have. They're just not in style right now. It's all Iron Man and stuff.
What's your kid? 2T? Or
he wears an 11 now.
11T?
Yeah.
That was a boring story. So, Raina's Wings is still...
I didn't bring it up, so, you know, don't blame me.
That is true.
Raina's... Are you about ready to go on to something else?
No. No, not at all, Pat. This whole episode was dedicated to your... inability, your incompetence regarding Batman shoes, just to be clear.
Okay.
All right. So
now we know the mystery topic.
I'm glad we called me in for this, because that's something I'm an expert on. Pat's incompetence. Wait, you incompetence or incontinence?
No, actually, you were an expert in his incompetence. You were there in the Star Trek game where they turned the unshielded aft of their ship directly
into your Klingon condom.
Yes.
What we turned it into.
Yeah.
They turned the unshielded backside of their ship directly into your fully armed forward firing arc. And I even stopped and asked them. I didn't coach them. I was like, are you sure you want to do this? Yeah, we've got it covered.
No. You said
okay.
That.
Okay.
No, specifically.
If you say so.
You made that comment only to me because you came over and saw what I was right. Because I was the science officer in charge of the shields. And you saw what I did and you're like, are you sure about this? I'm like, I've been told by my captain that he knows what he's doing.
So this is like a Nuremberg thing. You were just following orders.
Just following orders.
Hey, I was a good crewman. I was not insubordinate. I did what my captain asked.
Okay.
Pat, told me to do.
Pat, don't worry about it. I took care. I upheld Federation honor in the next game. It's no problem.
So,
Wayne...
It was a close game.
It was a very close game.
We certainly didn't turn our F to you.
That's
so
true.
Actually, our game, the rest of our game was really good. It was close up until that, the one really strategic mistake.
Until the
made.
Actual rape happened.
Well, that was bad, but even that didn't destroy us. Mm-hmm. We just, after that, we never did get a chance where we got back around where we could actually fire our weapons at them.
The game
after
was
that,
totally
was...
close until it was completely one-sided. So anyways, Raina's Wings is still going on through the end of the month before the walk. And this is something that I really want to stress the importance of because, I mean, all the jokes that we make on this show aside, your dollar really does matter. I mean, it really is going to researching solutions to what have been major family crises. And I have a lot of respect for Necro for putting forth the pain that his family has gone through as an attempt to do good that other families do not have to go through this. And if you're listening to this and you were of childbearing age or prior to childbearing age. This could affect you. Even if you're past childbearing age, this could still affect your family. In fact, I'm going to pledge on the show right here and right now that Fear the Boot as an entity is going to donate $100 by the time this show drops to Raina's Wings. And remember that if you donate to it or have donated to it and you let Necro know that you're from Fear the Boot, you will be put into a drawing for prizes from Drive Through, Art Dream, and Polymancer. So even if you have absolutely no altruistic streak in you whatsoever, for purely selfish reasons, get out there and do the right thing. Blood Bowl League, this is the last couple days for it. Cutoff is Thursday, May 6th at noon Central Time. We definitely have enough folks for Steam League. One way or another, we are moving forward, and the first round matchups will be posted at some point this coming Saturday.
And hey, if you have absolutely no interest in Blood Bowl, I want to point out something that's going on our forums in the video game section. There's a young man named Wizard. Hey, Wizard. Who is organizing the FTB Night of Carnage. And this is something that I've been kind of following off and on for a little while now. They've had a couple of people get into it. It started with StarCraft. They were just a couple of guys getting together. I think they do it on Sunday nights. And they've actually expanded it beyond StarCraft now. And they're doing other games, insert gaming.
You've been following this real closely, haven't you?
Well, it's a Star Wars, I think it's an RTS, it's a multiplayer RTS that's a Star Wars game, and I'm unfamiliar with it. So I don't remember the exact name of it. And they're doing other things as well as StarCraft. And they've actually got a pretty good following going right now. So if you're into a Sunday night of carnage, and I think they're just doing like RTSs and basically just gangbusters on it, check out the video games thread. Send Wizard a PM. It's in his SIG. It's in a couple of guys' SIGs on the forums. Just check it out. I'm sure they'd be glad to have you.
One last thing I'm going to draw your attention to before we drill down to the subjects for today's show is a lot of people ask us, Colin and Off, what the state is of our various projects like Skies of Glass or Epoch of Rhysos. I just did a fairly lengthy write-up on the forum, which I'm not going to reiterate on the show because this would be like a show unto itself. But I want you to know, if you're curious about where we are at with our various creative projects, check the show notes, because I am going to link to a thread where we explain, or I explain in detail, where each of them is at and what we're up to. So if you're interested, check that out. If not, then let's get down to it. So there's a phrase that is fairly common in our society.
You know, Dan, I kind of like how you're sitting there now, because Johan's here. Dan got a new chair, and it's one of his chairs that at least 4 or 5 inches above everybody else's chair. So he's like this British magistrate minus his wig, sitting above all of us, dictating topics and whatnot.
For the course of this one show, in addition to Dan, you may address me as Your Worm, Your Honor.
Your Worm, Your Honor.
Yes, that's perfectly fine.
Your Worm, Your Honor. I think you need to bring this chair to gaming on Sundays.
I'm just going to call you Lord Merkin, so.
Well, you know, that does bring up an interesting little anecdote. I got here a little bit early when I was heading on up from my house, and when I knocked on the door, Dan opened up, and he had a cane in his hand, and he had a big zebra stripe fur hat. And the first thing he said when he looked at me is, "Rule number one." I don't actually remember rule number one, sorry.
There were two rules. You will address me as Daddy and speak only when spoken to, just to be clear.
And that's rule street. Number one.
Yeah,
rule number one has two parts to it.
Well, and there's also the you know who street corner this is.
That's right.
That's right.
That's
and there's the rule before rule number one.
There's all kinds of rules.
Daddy always gets his cut.
That's right.
All right.
Daddy's always gets paid.
There's a phrase we've used on the show and is fairly common within pop culture in general, which is, the playground is smaller than you remember, or when you were little, the playground was bigger. There is a slight permutation of this phrase that entered into my mind this past week, which I want to kick around on this show.
This is the surprise topic that Dan is going to blow us away with. I am on the edge of my seat.
I don't know per se it's going to blow you guys away. It's just, I think to get a proper response, it had to be unprepped. If I'd prepped you guys for this, I don't think I could get the proper reaction.
He's been prepping us all week.
All right, so here's the phrase. The phrase is not the playground isn't as big as you remember, but the playground is a whole lot weirder than you remember. Now, we talk a lot about, in regards to nostalgia, there are these old shows or movies where you turn them on and, wow, they really suck, that you thought they were cool when you were a kid, but when you're an adult, not so much.
Quantum Leap.
Yeah. Quantum Leap, Voltron. There's all kinds of great examples to this. I'm sure everyone's got their own shows or movies, and we'd love to have you guys sound off on those on the forums. But this past week, Carl and I were looking for a movie to watch, and we were scrolling through all the...
You should watch Moon, by the way. I just saw that movie. It's wonderful. Go on.
Okay.
Continue.
Well, we were scrolling through On Demand. I was actually looking for Superman, Batman, Public Enemies, and was not able to find it in On Demand. Wasn't into Netflix streaming either. So I ended up settling on a movie that I have seen that she has not.
I'm going to stop you right there. Did you know Gorka Morka tried to get me on an obscure Swedish film? He's like, oh, have you ever seen this film? I bet you haven't. I'm like, yes, I have seen that film. Pachow! All right. Continue. Sorry.
It's Ka-chow.
No, it's Pachow in my world.
Okay.
I think that's the Swedish translation.
Yes, the Swedish translation.
Or is it the Swedish translation?
It was an Ingrid
Bergman.
He tried to get me on Ingrid Bergman's The Seventh Seal with Max von Sydow, and I have seen that with a very young Max von Sydow. It's a wonderful movie.
All right. Watching kids' movies today or kids' TV shows today, a lot of them are really sanitized compared to when our generation was growing up.
Definitely.
There's no smoking, drinking, racial stereotypes. Okay, some of the things they've eliminated make more sense than others.
When was the last time you saw smoking in like a kid's cartoon? Bugs Bunny, Tom and Jerry?
Yeah, smoking
it's been a long time.
Smoke a cigar, something like that. But if you look back at children's fairy tales, I'm talking like the Brothers Grimm or whatnot. These fairy tales and stories that were meant for kids had some really disturbing themes to them that we do not present in the way that we tell stories to children today. So as Carl and I were sitting there going through these on-demand movies, I suggested a movie that I had seen as a child. And I remembered even as a child being fairly disturbing, but I don't think I appreciated just how disturbing until I rewatched it as an adult, which was a 1985 movie. It was a sequel to The Wizard of Oz called Return to Oz.
That was pretty bizarre.
I've seen that one a couple times.
Okay, good. People can't hear you nod, so I'm glad. I love it when you talk. It's a very strange movie that has a lot of disturbing themes to it.
When I describe this movie to people that have never seen it, they think I'm crazy that it doesn't actually exist. It is a very messed up movie.
Well, did you know that The Wizard of Oz is actually a whole... It's based on book.
No, it's not based on a book.
That's it's based on a series of books.
Yes, that's where I was going to start. Is The Wizard of Oz...
There's a lot of stories to it.
I had heard that The Wizard of Oz was based upon a book. Well, upon doing a little bit of looking into it, The Wizard of Oz and that whole series is not based on a book. It was actually based on a series of 14 novels and a whole bunch more spin-off works. Musicals, plays, short stories, anthologies, whatever. But there were 14 core novels to the series that were written around the turn of the century. And of course, by turn of century, I mean the 1800s to the 1900s. I don't mean the 1900s to the 2000s. But they were written around the turn of the century by an American author. When I saw Return to Oz as a kid, I just presumed, well, this must be some kind of unofficial, made up, purely pulled out of the butt sequel to The Wizard of Oz, which is not the case in any way, shape, or form. It's actually based on two novels, which is The Marvelous Land of Oz and Ozma of Oz, both of which were real novels from the series, and sort of a mushing together of those two storylines that was written by the same guy that wrote The Wizard of Oz. But even The Wizard of Oz, the movie, was based on the book The Wonderful Wizard of Oz. The book was a whole lot more disturbing than the movie was. The movie was highly sanitized.
That book is actually on my pile of books at home that I'm waiting to get to.
Well, that book was a commentary on the economic status in the early 1900s, if I remember correctly.
It was a commentary on a lot of things. The guy had, just like Alice in Wonderland, the guy had some very sharp political and economic views that figured into the storyline. And a lot of that either got sanitized out from the movie or just people today wouldn't pick up on that just because we don't live in those times. But as I was watching Return to Oz, before I later found out that it was actually based on real novels, I remembered a whole slew of rather disturbing themes. For starters, while you still have room to wonder, it's much more strongly implied that Dorothy is out of her gourd, that Oz is not a real place. She is genuinely insane.
I think it was a Masterpiece Theater or something, some Channel 9 thing where they played it like that. They did A Wizard of Oz and they played it like that where she was off her rocker and they kind of showed her going off to the asylum, and then all the characters, like the Wicked Witch and the Wizard and all that, were different people in her life as she was going, woo, off the ranch. You know what? Did Wizard of Oz scare you as a kid?
No. Return to Oz did.
Now, Wizard of Oz didn't scare me as a kid, but if I remember right, The Wiz scared me. As silly as it sounded, the Michael Jackson one?
Well,
The
Wiz. I think that's understandable.
Yeah,
that's good reason why that should have disturbed you.
Yeah. I mean, that, besides that, the inference, but I mean, it like, they had, like, creatures and stuff, and I was a little kid. I hope I don't have the dates messed up, and I was like 14.
No, you would have been. I remember The Wiz, and I don't. It was back when Michael Jackson was really at his height, when Thriller came out.
When he was black.
Yeah, back when he was black and alive, and all those things, and not wanted on various crimes and all that stuff. But there was a comment made in Return to Oz near the start of the movie when Dorothy is sitting talking to, I guess we'll call him a psychiatrist. He really wasn't. He was a medical hack, but we'll call him a psychiatrist.
In that time, he would have been called an alienist.
She makes a comment that the Tin Man was made of tin because his axe had been cursed by one of the Wicked Witches such that he had hacked off all of his limbs one by one until they had all been replaced with metallic parts and he was no longer human.
Right.
And I'm like, wow, that is messed up. This has got to be something they just added in there to try and be creepy.
Yeah, from what I understand, that is straight from the
book.
That
is straight from the book.
Let me read you a plot synopsis from The Tin Man of Oz, okay, which was not the book this was based on, but explains his origin. And I want you guys to keep in mind, as I read this, this is supposed to be a children's book, okay? This is not meant for adults. This is not meant for Stephen King fans. This is meant for you to read to your six-year-old.
You know, Stephen King did write a kid's book.
Yes, I know he did.
It was very good.
Eye of the Dragon, right?
Eyes of the Dragon.
Eyes of the Dragon, mm-hmm. Okay. But this is meant for you to read to your six-year-old before you tuck them in tonight. Here's a plot synopsis. The Tin Woodman and the Scarecrow are regaling each other with tales at the former's palace in the Winky Country. Go ahead, Pat. Thank you. When a Gillikin boy named Woot, very excited fellow, wanders in and is welcomed into their presence. After he is fed and rested, Woot asks the Woodman how he became made of tin. He relates how the Wicked Witch of the East enchanted his axe and caused him to chop his body parts off limb by limb because he was in love with her ward, Nimmy Amy. Each chopped limb was replaced by the tinsmith, Kuklip, with a counterpart made of tin. Side note, since Oz is a fairyland, no one can die even when the parts of their body are separated from each other. All right, now this is just the start. It gets weirder from here. However, without a heart, since he's cut his body apart, the Tin Woodman felt he could no longer love Nimmy Amy, and therefore he left her. He relates how Dorothy and the Scarecrow found him after he had rusted in the forest, an event related in The Wonderful Wizard of Oz, or we would know as the movie The Wizard of Oz, and went with him to the Emerald City, where the wizard gave him a heart, so he could love this woman again. The plot element, as far as I know, completely left out of The Wizard of Oz movie. Woot poses that the heart may have made him kind, but it did not make him loving, because he would have returned to Nimmy Amy if he loved her. This shames and inspires him to journey to the Munchkin Country and find her. Okay, skip ahead a little bit in this book. The Tin Woodman, the Scarecrow, Woot, and some other guy they picked up named Polychrome resume their quest and come upon the spot that the Tin Woodman stood rusted to find another Tin Man. Now, this is where I came to find out Fear the Boot is apparently way behind its time.
No way.
We were apparently, and I'm not talking in the fastest sense, I'm talking, we were apparently really beating the market here by about a century. After they oil his joints, he, referring to this other tin guy, identifies himself as Captain Fighter, a soldier who courted Nimmy Amy after the Woodman had left her. The Wicked Witch of the East made Fighter's sword do what the Woodman's axe did.
God, I hate chicks with baggage.
Cut off his limbs, which Kuklip replaced with tin limbs. He did not have a heart either, but it did not bother Fighter. It's a dump stat. I mean, how hard is
next
a dump
on,
stat?
Next on Jerry Springer, who is Nimmy Amy's baby's father?
Both Tin Woodsmen now seek the heart of Nimmy Amy, and they agree to let her choose between them.
like heart as in love or heart as in boom, boom, boom,
that's boom, what boom,
boom, heart as in love. Like, we're getting to that part. We haven't gotten to the creepiest part of the story yet, but we're talking heart as in who she's going to love, whether it's the now completely robotic, though they wouldn't put it in those terms, woodsman, or the completely robotic fighter, though in this story felt fighter.
I'm smelling robot fanfic.
I wish that would be less creepy than how this ends. So the group of them come to the dwelling of the Tin Smith Kuklip, where the Tin Woodsman talks to himself, meaning that is the head of the man, Nick Chopper, he once was. So he's having a discussion with his own severed head. The Tin Woodsman and the Tin Soldier also find a barrel of assorted body parts that once belonged to each of them. But some, like Captain Fighter's head, are conspicuously missing. Dun, dun, dun. Where could they have gone? Fat's making sexual gestures. No, this is actually creepier than that.
Wow.
Kuklip reveals that he used Fighter's head and many body parts from each of them, which never decayed, to create Chop Fight for an assistant.
I'm thinking a slap chop, chop fight mix up is in order here.
Chop Fight complained about missing an arm until Kuklip made him a tin one and he departed for the east. The companions leave Kuklip and continue east themselves to find Nimmy Amy.
That's going to bring You're Going to Love My Nuts to a whole new meaning.
Oh, here's the climax of the story. Let's just review to this point.
Oh, do we have to?
What we have here is not some cutesy musical singing version of a rusted tin man.
Yeah.
We have a guy who fell in love with the ward of a witch who cursed his axe so that he sat there chopping off his own limbs as this guy named Kuklip replaced them with tin parts, or what we would call today robotic parts, until there is nothing of him left that's human.
It's very steampunk.
Except a severed head, which he's having a conversation with, and a barrel full of body parts. A soldier comes
that
along.
That aren't rotting. It's not that bad. They're not rotting.
They're just sitting there.
They're just sitting there.
In this world, you can't die by having your head, body parts, your head chopped off.
Right.
But heaven forbid a house fall on you. That's going to kill you.
It's an innocent, childish story where being dismembered doesn't kill you. Okay? Just put this in perspective. So then
kids were a lot tougher back then. They were less coddled.
Yeah. So then they come across. They rode their bikes without helmets and such.
Well, but they're pinning farthings anyway.
They learned to avoid baths because apparently water can kill you too. So
then along comes this guy who's cleverly named Fighter. We'll have to give Mr. Bums, I guess, staying up all night on that name. And he falls in love with the same woman and cuts off his limbs as well under the same curse until he becomes the Tin Soldier. And Kuklip, who's the nut job who's doing all of this at the witch's behest, is just keeping all their body parts in a barrel. He's not burying them or anything. He's just hanging on to them.
Well, what else are you going
to
do?
At which point, he decides to sew them together, just, you know, a little from column A, a little from column B, to make Nick Chopper and Fighter into this third individual called Chop Fight.
This is sounding like a 4th edition D&D campaign to me already. I mean, so you got this flesh war, right, you got two war forged, right?
Here's the climax of the story.
Uh-huh.
So the 10 woodsmen and 10 soldier knock on, referring to Nimmy Amy's door, and are admitted by Nimmy Amy, who is now married to Chop Fight.
You know what part she used, right?
Kuklip's erstwhile assistant made of their human body parts. She refuses to leave her domestic life.
It's Chop Fight. That guy's awesome.
Who'd want to give up the...
He took down Macho Man Randy Savage in the third round.
Who'd want to give up this great domestic lifestyle, being the Stepford wife to Frankenstein's monster?
Well, yeah,
made out of cursed body parts.
You got two.
Well, the body parts aren't cursed anymore.
And here's the up to it, because the Tin Man has reached a particular political title, and so she is unwilling to leave them, even to marry the Tin Woodsman, which would make her the Empress of the Winkies. And she says, all I ask is to be left alone and not to be disturbed by visitors.
Well, I hate to tell you this, Dan. Do you know what Chop Fight has that no other man has? He has two copies.
Indeed.
First of all, for anyone who thinks I'm just making this up, I'm going to link this in the show notes just so you can read this for yourself. Follow the whole series. It is messed up. I mean, top to bottom, messed up. The wizard himself is not such a good guy. He's not the innocent, bumbling guy with a big, smoky face that he projects. This whole series is screwed the hell up.
That's pretty much typical of kids' stories, though. I mean, if you actually look back at the fables, these were tales that they told the kids to scare them into line.
Well, yeah, to keep them out of the Black Forest, yeah, where a wolf really might actually kill them.
And I think in this case, it's even a little bit more off than that, because the Wonderland books were not kids' stories when they were written. They were political satire.
Yeah, these were, though. I mean, you're correct. The Wonderland books were not. While they took the form of a children's story and Disney turned them into children's stories.
I'm sorry. Wonderland is not what I meant. I meant the Oz books.
Right.
Those were political satire.
But he marketed these to kids. Now, I'm sure in all this, there is a really messed up series of setting or plot ideas for a role-playing game, which I'll kick back from the postcards from the Dungeon Guys, because that's really kind of their angle. But the angle that we're going to take, or I'm going to take, is there a piece of game mastering advice in this, which is as follows.
Don't play 4E.
Don't multi-class.
Yes, yes.
Johan at feartheboot.com. It's not a real address, so send all the hate mail you want. Hate mail, furry porn, whatever. But is there a piece of game mastering advice in this, which is that when you are trying to run a horror game and genuinely capture that horror feeling, which is hard to do, mm-hmm, it's easy to make people laugh at a table. It's easy to make people get intense at a table. But it's really hard to make people afraid while they're sitting around looking at dice and Cheetos. But is there maybe an opportunity here to add horror to a game, not through fright or startling them or disgusting them, but instead just through raw, acid-tripping, messed-up peculiarity?
Absolutely. That's the best way to do it. If you really want to scare people who are not in a situation where they're in any actual danger, such as at an RPG table, you can't do it through threat. You can't do it through intimidation. You can't show them blood spattered on the screen. You can try to describe it, but their mind will intuitively edit out anything that they are incapable of seeing. So you're not going to gross them out that way, really. The way to do it is by throwing at them things that their mind can't wrap itself around or that is intrinsically disturbing to them. For example, somebody who is cursed to cut off his own body parts and get them mechanically replaced until he's nothing but an automaton who is working for no other reason than the fact that he works to cut down trees.
And loses his heart, and so goes to see the wizard to get a heart back so he can find the woman he loves. And then when he finally finds her, she's in love with the stitched together parts of his original body.
Sure, absolutely.
Hey, the part she cared about the most apparently was still there. So.
And doubly so.
Right.
The Tin Woody Man.
I think there's an opportunity even more than that, especially since you're bringing up the children's stories. If you tie in a gaming reference, especially subtly, to a children's fable, that's inherently going to take your players back mentally to when they were children listening to fables. If you put it into that genre of this is a children's story, but a creepy one, I think they're going to respond to it a whole lot differently than they would if you portray it as a Stephen King novel.
Why is that? I agree with you, but for a moment I'd like to deconstruct why that is. Just going off here on a tangent, of why is the juxtaposition of a children's story with horror elements so much more creepy than an adult story with horror elements?
Innocence.
Yes.
It's innocence standing next to the horror that makes it really cool and really dark and really creepy. And
do you think maybe it also kind of regresses people back to a point in their life when they were more helpless? I hate to be so Freudian, but
no, I don't think it does. I don't get that sense from it. It's hard for me to explain why. I don't think that people identify with the child aspect in that. I think that they see that innocence, and it is not the innocence or the corruption of the innocence. It is the contrast that makes the horror stand out more.
I think for me, there is a sense of helplessness, but I think maybe it's because of the fact, and Wayne, I know you went through this as well. Growing up, I had an intense and inordinate number of nightmares. And so for me, there was a sense of helplessness at the hands of the horrible as a child.
Look at these stories, though. Hansel and Gretel, the witch eats children. I mean, that's pretty effed up, right? The witch and the children overcome. They're not helpless. You look at Alice in Wonderland. Alice overcomes the adversity. She overcomes the Red Queen. she wins. She's not helpless. Look at
Wizard of Oz. They crush cross one wish and water
kill another.
The other
one. Dorothy is not helpless. They're the hero, and that's actually how.
That's a fair point.
That's how you come through this. That's why that horror works so well. It's not a horror in how we think of a lot of modern horror movies, where you have a cast of five characters and four and a half of them make it. You know, the one guy makes it, but he's so twisted, and you know the monster. You know he's coming back anyway at the end. No, in these stories, it is the contrast between good and evil, between innocence and horror. And one of the hallmarks of that is that the innocence overcomes.
I think you're very much modernizing it, though. If you look to like the original stories from Grimm, that's not true.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, innocence always overcome.
Do you know the actual story of Sleeping Beauty?
Yeah, I do. And also, like Little Mermaid, too. Little Mermaid dies at the end. Oh, spoilers! But I think that sometimes in some of these stories that does overcome. But I look at stuff like Sleeping Beauty, and I look at stuff like Little Mermaid, and it's different. That's not what we're talking about here. You don't have that sort of same Alice in Wonderland or Yellow Brick Road or even with Grimm's Fairy Tales, the Hansel and Gretel thing of the innocence of children contrasted and juxtaposed against the horror. It's sort of a different thing. The story more follows the children, and it's more about a corruption and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm.
We've talked about a couple different angles, but how do you integrate all this into a role-playing game?
I think you're taking it from the wrong perspective. It's not the GM. The GM paints this world, right?
Right.
Writes this story.
Okay.
And the GM can go as weird or off the wall as you want. The GM can read the Alice in Wonderland. He can drop a book of stamps. He can listen to a whole bunch of Jimi Hendrix. He can listen to Echo and the Bunnymen and get really weird and write this campaign, right?
Right.
That's not the problem. The issue comes in with the players. The players have to buy in. What the Game Master is presenting, the players have to look at it, and he paints this weird, we'll say Alice in Wonderland, this weird world full of potions and mushrooms and Cheshire cats and people with top hats being crazy. And if they look at it and they're snickering and giggling and stuff, it's not going to work.
Or even worse, if they eat one half of the mushroom and they grow to 40 feet tall, and their first question is, what does that make my strength?
Right, right. It's like, where's the queen? I'm going to step on her
right now.
Yeah. The players have to buy into it. And how you get them to buy in as a game master, now bringing this back to the game master, you have to do one of two things. You have to know your players. Is this something that they are willing to buy in? Is this something they're into? Or do they just want a different kind of game? But the other thing is communication. You have to talk to your players and say, this is what I'm going for. This is what the feel I'm trying to do, and this is what I need from you guys. Do you think that that would work with you guys? Do you think that that is something that you can buy into? What do you need from me to help you buy into the bizarre, like, we are going off the rails, off the ranch, and I want to mix horror elements into this. What do you need from me to make this work?
I think it would be harder for that to be creepy if you know it's coming. Creepiest thing that I have ever seen in a role-playing game was, you know, you were actually running it at the time, and it's this...
I took my shirt off.
Well, that's scary. That's not creepy.
Pat dropping trowel was the creepiest thing I've ever seen in a role-playing game.
Well, that's true, too. But as part of the game itself was this cute little girl you had come out, and then suddenly two or three more of this little girl come out, and they're laughing. And it's this purely innocent thing that is now an incredible, powerful evil that's surrounding us. That was creepy as hell.
You know why that was creepy?
Because I wasn't expecting it.
You weren't expecting it, and I forced you guys into a moment of perceived helplessness. Like you said, you don't know why. You don't know what's going on. You weren't expecting it. This little girl comes out. The instant you know, you are surrounded by evil. But what are you going to do? You're big, tough warriors. You're armed to the teeth. You have the skills to kill. Your mages have the ability to bend reality. Are you really going to kill a little girl who
exactly
has done nothing but laugh at you?
And if you had come to us beforehand and said, I'm going to do something a little bit different this week. I'm going to do something a little bit creepy. Or what do you need from me to be able to do something creepy? I think that would have taken away from it. It was more effective because we weren't expecting it.
I think that you can slip that into individual games. Like it's just slip-ins. The whole game wasn't like that. But I slipped that in, and that was a moment. And you're absolutely right. You can't plan. I couldn't plan for that sort of thing.
I didn't even plan for it.
No, I mean, I didn't.
It was we reacted to it, and then suddenly instead of one, there's five of them.
Yeah. But I think that when you're talking about a whole campaign, that you haven't started yet, I think that's when you have that conversation. And you don't play your cards. You hold your, as a game master, you hold your cards very close to your chest and don't do any of your reveals or gives, but you got to find out from your players. You got to get them invested in it from the beginning.
Is there an RPG that that's not true of?
Well, I think that you can come to the table and you can say, guys, we're going to play a science fiction game. They're like, all right, you know, yeah, space aliens and spaceships and lasers and stuff. Okay, cool. Sounds good. And that's all the conversation you need to have. I think there's so many ways to do horror wrong that the people who come into it as players, and I don't want to say that they need to get prepped because that's not it at all. But I think that as a game master, you need to find out if your players are into it. It's so simple for horror to turn into comedy or horror to turn into action or horror to turn into anything that is anything but horror.
I think even worse is the possibility of horror turning into formula. I think this was really epitomized in the Scream movies, particularly the first one.
It was epitomized in every horror movie in the last 10 years.
Well, but in the Scream movie where there's one character who sets out to explain this is what's going to happen. And in fact, that is exactly what happened through the rest of the movie. And when you can reach that kind of formula...
That reminds me of the movie Catch Me If You Can, which is not a horror movie. If you watch the movie, they tell you the story three times. The opening credits tell you the entire story through wordless animation as the names come down. When the movie starts, it's being narrated, and the narrator tells you the entire story, beginning, middle, and end, before the story starts. And then the movie starts, and then they tell you the whole story. And it's great. It works. But that has nothing to do with what we're talking about.
So, thanks for adding that, though. Two pieces of recommendation that I would have. The first is, I think to some degree, these primeval or visceral fears that we have deserve an amount of introspection. That if you watch a movie or read a book or hear a story or have a dream that genuinely creeps you out, sitting back and asking why, and really introspecting about, not specifically this one image creeped me out, because the image that creeped you out may not creep somebody else out, but understanding the mechanics behind why that creeped you out. It creeped me out because it hit so close to home. I had a nightmare where the aggressor was my own mother. Something like that. And it's that sense of closeness. But you start to deconstruct why something creeped you out. But the second thing I'd recommend is subtlety.
Alfred Hitchcock understood that in horror, less is more.
Oh, yes. Yeah. And I think he's absolutely right that the implied is worse than the realized.
Wes Craven did not understand that.
Well, no, none of
what I'm going to come up with in my mind is far scarier than anything you're going to show me on the screen.
Precisely, because I don't know what scares you.
The original House on Haunted Hill, the original black and white movie, very creepy, very scary, very fun movie. The remake, special effects, barf all over the screen, and it was not scary at all.
But the second thing, and I guess maybe this kind of ties into that, is subtlety. You don't per se push somebody in a certain direction. You just gently nudge them in a certain direction. There was a game that I ran, and this was years ago, and I don't remember a lot of the details, but I remember that the party, it was a D&D game. They were in the house of a fairly well-to-do necromancer, but he wasn't the overt necromancer. It wasn't like he had skeletons and zombies running around. This was a wealthy guy with a mansion, and you just saw a few things that kind of implied he was into some things he ought not be into. And in the mood of the moment, there was this situation where the party goes up to his bedroom and finds like a, like a bureau or something with a mirror on it. And beneath the mirror was a little tiny brass plaque that was engraved with the phrase, "Till death do us part." And that really weirded one of the players out. You know, it wasn't bodies pouring through the walls or blood coming out of the elevator or whatever. It was just this little thing of when the guy looks in the mirror, what he's reading is "Till death do us part." And that sense of subtlety.
I think a lot of it is the same thing that happens with any sort of storytelling, which is that almost any story that you're going to tell is a collection of tropes. You have to do it in such a way that it doesn't seem like it's nothing but a collection of tropes, but it almost always is, and it's getting the right mixture, and it's hiding it just enough so that it's not blatant, but they have to be obvious enough for the people to cue off of. And I think that's one of the difficult things with horror, is getting the mix just right. And I think that's one of the things that adding that sense of creepiness will help with, because that's enough to trigger in the brains of the reader, the watcher, the player, that, okay, I'm going into a horror story now. Something isn't right here. Normal people don't have that written on their mirror. Normal people don't cut their arms off and replace them with tin, whatever it may be. And it's just that sense of other that you have to put into it that is really going to cue their brains to say, okay, this is the mode we're going into. Whereas if you throw an alien in front of them, the cue is, I'm going to shoot it with a gun. This is an action sequence.
Yeah.
And it's getting that right mix of tropes. And subtlety is certainly a part of it, because you don't want to be blatant about it or it's just going to come off as cheesy.
That was the difference between Alien and Aliens.
Right.
In Alien, they didn't have guns.
Right.
And there was only one, and it was a lot of dark passages and such, as all those different tropes of being alone and being helpless. And Alien was a horror movie.
Right.
Aliens
had an action sci-fi movie.
Was an action sci-fi movie. They had guns. They were running. It was all these different, they were space marines in a team, and they weren't ever alone. And
it had the horror element that was primarily brought in by Newt.
Yep.
You had the juxtaposition of innocence. Mm-hmm. And that was
innocence
the
and helplessness.
Right.
Yeah.
That was the trope that they brought in to cue your brain, which is why people still think of it as a horror movie.
Mm-hmm.
Even though it really wasn't.
Yeah.
It was an action sci-fi movie, but it had just enough element of horror that you think that when you watch it, you know, you cue off of that. And I think you can do the same thing in a role-playing game.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a matter of finding the right mix.
I wonder if this is one of the reasons why creepy movies, dated as they may get, are still so powerful and effective, even outside of their time frame, is because so much of it is brought to the table by the consumer, even if unwittingly so. I just mentioned Return to Oz as one example, but I think another great example of this would be Forbidden Planet. And I've heard they're doing a remake, so I just want to get this out here now before I have to clarify which one I mean. But Forbidden Planet's another one. If you've never seen it, I highly recommend giving it a rental or giving it a watch. It's an old classic sci-fi horror movie where a lot of things are much more strongly implied than shown. And I have to wonder if to some degree is because they lack the special effects to show things. So they had to, God forbid, storytell.
That's why old BBC is so wonderful. They had such a great tradition. They had absolute for special effects. But
they had flashlights.
Oh, hell yeah, they had flashlight. They had a
Blake
lot of...
Blake 7.
Yep.
Never... If you've got flashlight and strings, you have a budget.
I was never so afraid of incandescence as watching Blake 7.
Hey, man, I'm telling you, that old... Not just Doctor Who, everyone knows I'm a huge Doctor Who fan, but all that old BBC stuff did great stories, great writing, great acting. Now, of course, not everyone hit them out of the park. There's tons that got canceled and were crappy, but they didn't have to rely so much on the special effects, I think. I think special effects tend to be a crutch. I think you can make a perfectly good low-budget horror movie. Unfortunately, low-budget in horror nowadays doesn't mean suspense or thrilling or horror. It's gore.
It's gore.
Because blood, fake blood's cheap. It's kill a serpent, die.
Gore or startle.
Yeah. Yeah. See, that's what I hate about horror movies. I don't watch horror movies. I love movies. I don't really watch horror movies because horror movies aren't horrifying. They aren't thrilling. They aren't even scary. They're startling. It is walking down the hall and your roommate jumps out of a closet and yells boo. And your adrenaline gets surged. You jump out of your chair and then you calm down. Then you come down and it's like, that doesn't do it for me. There are people who love that kind of movie and it doesn't do it for me. And you know what? That doesn't work in a role-playing game. You can't do that in a role-playing game. It just doesn't work. I guess if you're LARPing, you might get them once or twice.
Well, if you whip out a starter pistol and pull it.
Yeah.
I guess you can startle your players.
You know what? That works once.
Yeah. And on top of that, I think that's also a cheap thing to do. That was my biggest complaint with the movie Signs. I know a lot of people have a lot of different complaints, but my biggest complaint with Signs was the fact that it was a startle movie. I didn't mind the fact that it was more about a man's loss and recovery of faith than an alien invasion, despite how the trailers portrayed it. But that really wasn't my number one complaint. My number one complaint was the startle movie. I left the theater in the middle of a panic attack. I mean, that's...
You know how you were saying... I think you were saying, Wayne, it's like it's all about surprise. It's all about surprising your character. characters and your players, I think that's the danger of surprise, is signs. Dan's a huge M. Night fan.
Signs wasn't a surprise. It was startled. There's a difference.
No. What I'm saying is he saw these trailers. It was a certain kind of movie. And what did M. Night do? He put aliens in it. Where the hell did that come from?
Another movie I put out there is an example of this. And I know this movie gets some kind of mixed reviews for a variety of reasons.
Tank Girl.
God, no.
Oh, Tank Girl was awesome.
I love Tank Girl. Tank Girl's rocks.
It was a frightening movie, but for a completely different reason.
It had Ice-T.
Awesome.
It's a win in my book.
No.
The worst problem with Tank Girl was a lack of Jet Girl and the lack of Submarine Girl.
Jet Girl was probably the highlight of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
But to prove that I am the Magnus Magnusson of movie watching, to prove I can endure anything, if Tank Girl and A Sound Like Thunder wasn't enough to prove that I can withstand anything.
Not impressed. I've seen them both.
I sat through Barbed Wire.
Again, I've seen it as well.
That's a whole lot of silicone and latex for one movie.
Have you sat through Incredible Hulk in the theater, then I'll be impressed. Although I did that as well.
I'm sorry,
guys. Phil sat through Battlefield Earth.
I've not sat through in theater.
Theaters, all of it, and went to work, and then at work, about a couple hours later, collapsed and had to be taken to the hospital.
That sounds about right.
True facts right there.
You want to know happened. Why? Because they had leverage over him.
What was I even going to say?
Oh, yes. Fire in the Sky. is another movie where while they do outright show some things, there are other things that are strongly implied. For anyone that's not familiar with the movie, it's an alien abduction story based, quote unquote, on a true story. I'll let you make that decision yourself. And there's a scene in the alien abduction where they start the medical experimentation thing. They put him on a table, restrain him, and you see this hideous device coming down over him. You get the sense it's about to do terrible things. And the scene ends. They don't show what it does to him. I mean, you get some idea of what it does to him. They show a couple things, but you never really get the sense of what this guy endured. And the next time you see him, he is just this huddled shell of a traumatized human being sitting naked in a gas station in the middle of nowhere begging for help. You're hardly able to speak. He's like almost catatonic. And what happened between those two scenes to this guy is left entirely to your imagination. And I guess this kind of speaks to Johan's thing of you have these tropes, you have these images, these social archetypes of events that are never really exactly explained, and it leaves the consumer's mind there to fill in the details.
I think implied storytelling is great. I think it's a wonderful storytelling technique. I absolutely love it. That's why I'm such a huge fan of Valve games, because they are masters of implied storytelling within video games. My question is...
Oh, yeah, the entire story of Portal is told in graffiti.
Yeah, exactly. You should play Left 4 Dead. There's tons of implied... Well, yeah, you do play Left 4 Dead.
I have Left 4 Dead.
You have played Left 4 Dead. There's tons of that kind of stuff in there, and they keep building it more and more. Now, here's the thing. Does implied storytelling work in a role-playing game?
I think it does. I think that you can look at things like Portal... or like Fire in the Sky, or like Return to Oz, for some clues that you can start to go for the surreal, the unusual, the abstract, the half spelled out. But I think you have a situation in a role-playing game that is both boon and bane, which is the fact that you have a feedback loop. The fact that the players are talking amongst themselves and talking to you. Now, the problem with that is, depending on their mood, they could take what you create to be the creepiest, most sinister thing of this bloody hand streak on the wall with "help me" next to it, and they make a joke out of it. But while that's the negative side to it, the positive
side... Give me a hand. Yeah, cook.
Yeah, exactly. Is you can also pick up on what it is they're latching onto. In the Skies of Glass game, where Pat's character had to kill another character, an NPC, and it really felt not like killing an NPC, but it felt to him almost like murder. And he as a human being got really creeped out by it. That was something that I as a game master was able to pick up on. It's not a firing free. You do a movie or a novel or whatever, you put it on paper, you put it on film, and you hope it has the effect you want. As a game master, you have that real-time feedback of what they're picking up on, what's working, what isn't. And even if you're not fast enough on your feet to adjust it this game, you can always go home and really analyze how it worked out and come back ready for that next game. And I think certainly, once again, I would highly recommend introspection, because while every human being is unique, I mean, we're all snowflakes and all that crap, the fact is there are many things that we have in common. I mean, we share common.
You are not a beautiful and unique snowflake. Yeah,
well, even beautiful and unique snowflake, guess what? You're still a snowflake. You're still a...
You are a snowflake.
You're still a hexagonal structure of water that melts at 33 degrees.
Face is a hexagonal structure of water. Yeah.
There are still things we have in common where I think if you can look at and really understand why something scared you, not what, but why... Mm-hmm. You may be right there on the path to understanding the visceral fears that will apply to any human being.
So I played a game at Fear the Con, and Pat is going to moan and roll his eyes because I bored that crap out of him with the story to game called Free Market. And Free Market's a silly game. And it
was this one where we kicked Chris's ass at diplomacy?
No, that was a different game.
Oh, I'm sorry. I get these.
I don't want to get into what Free Market is. There's a whole wide internet out there that has more information than I can give on it. But it's a silly game, and it's a sci-fi, and you're basically on a space station where you're effectively immortal. No one can die, or when you die, no matter how horrible the death, you're brought back to life. So all of your needs are met. The Maslow's hierarchy of needs are met. So you have your security, you have your...
It struck me very much as if Gene Roddenberry had written Paranoia.
Yes, exactly. And what we were doing in it was we were the happy fun squad, and we ran basically a fun house, a horror house, because no one can die. No one really feels pain unless if they don't want to. No one is ever actually in danger anymore, so nobody actually feels things like true fear. No one ever feels that they're in danger. And what people paid our group to do was to make them feel that fear. Yet, when we came into the game, we didn't have any idea how our characters did this.
Do you realize that you have created a metagame microcosm of the very real problem? The problem of a role-playing game is how do you make somebody feel afraid when they're in no danger?
Yeah.
And so you played a game where the objective was to make somebody feel afraid when they're in no danger.
Exactly.
That you've created a...
And we had to solve that problem in-game. It was awesome.
You were playing like the M.C. Escher role-playing game.
Yeah. It was really crazy. We had to be very creative on how we did that. And we had to really, our characters and us had to really look at tapping those primal fears. And I think that's the inherent problem in role-playing games and role-playing a horror game, is that all these things that trigger horror in your mind, you don't actually experience those in a role-playing game. You never really are in danger. You never really have a chance of dying. Your characters do. And I think the more in character you get, the more you start feeling
And I think, now, I think that a role-playing game is actually inherently a much better genre for portrayal of horror than a novel is.
Mm-hmm.
Because you do have a closer tie to the character than you do to a character in a novel. And I think you'd be hard-pressed to make the argument that you can't portray horror in a novel. You know, there's people have made an awful lot of money doing so.
Well, I think that one of the different, like a quick example on that is in a role-playing game, you're going down the corridor.
Mm-hmm.
So you hear heavy breathing behind the door and you hear scratches and you know that there's something in the house and it could be behind the door. Then the question is asked, what do you do? Well, I don't open that door. I make a run for it. Now, in a novel, the character walks down the hall.
Mm-hmm.
Hears the scratches,
mm-hmm.
Hears the breathing, reaches a hand, shaking and pale, out for the doorknob, clutches the doorknob, all the while you're saying, don't open the door, and he does. I'm not saying in a role-playing game you can't build horror, you can't build fear, because I have been afraid in a role-playing game. I have been in great horror games, but it's a different kind of
certainly
thing.
95% of horror is built upon artificial stupidity, which you can't expect to play out in a role-playing game, but I would make the argument like this. You are in no danger while playing a role-playing game, but you're also in no danger while reading a book. You're in no danger while sitting in...
Paper cuts are deadly.
Well, those apply in role-playing games, too.
Yeah.
Believe me.
You're in no danger while sitting in a movie theater. You're in no danger while watching.
I just read an article about a week ago of somebody getting stabbed in the neck with a turkey baster whilst in a movie theater.
How does that even happen?
Actually, I think it was a meat thermometer, not a turkey.
Okay, I could see that.
Yeah. Were they done?
But oh, you're in rare form.
Oh, well done.
I think you're both pretty baked.
But, you know, boys, you're in no danger in any of these circumstances.
Stop grilling me.
It's creating the illusion of danger. It's creating a sense of horror, even when there really ought not be one. And I would certainly say that in addition to you as a game master having some responsibility for setting the scenario, for building the drama, for creating the mystery, it's also incumbent upon the players to want to buy into it.
Yes.
When people go in to see a horror movie, they want to be scared. When people pick up a horror novel,
there's two types of people who go and see a horror movie. There's those who want to be scared and those who want to see the zipper.
Well, okay.
And that's fine. Both are paying their money and both are getting their ride.
And then there's
The thing is,
I won't fill in the name, but they go into these movies drunk and high on weed just to laugh at the whole thing.
Well, of course.
But the point is that if you are going there with the proper, quote unquote, proper intention.
Well, in my idea, though, if you have a group of people and half the people in the role-playing game group are there to be scared and the other half are there to see the zipper, it's not going to be a really scary game.
No, it's not. But I mean, I think there are things that you can do if the players are willing to buy into it. Here's a simple experiment. Watch a horror movie in a theater in the dark. Now go home, turn on all the lights, turn on a radio station in the background, watch the same movie on HBO. Guess what? It ain't going to scare you one tiny bit. And the same thing is true in a role-playing game, that you have to get that buy-in from the players. And
sit in a room in the dark.
Naked.
With Pat.
Oh, that scares me.
To some extent, they have to want it. I mean, I think there's only so much the game master can do.
I think you definitely need a lot more buy-in, because if you've got the people sitting around on their phones or talking between, you know, when their character isn't doing anything,
cracking jokes, or
yeah,
every NPC's name becomes an obscene pun or whatever.
It's hard to get past that in a regular game, but in a horror game, I don't see any way to get past that in a horror
game. The few good horror games I've been in, I mean, yeah, we've done the silly stuff. We've had the game master gives a creepy setting and we're playing by candlelight instead of having the actual lights on. But at the end of the day, is that what makes it scary? No, absolutely not. It's the conscious choice by the players to buy into the setting and to want to play along.
And I really think that's true of any genre of role-playing game that you sit down to play. A comedy game is not funny if the players don't make it funny.
Yeah,
you know, you can't have a hard sci-fi game that is brutal and gritty if the players are making fun of the Admiral's name.
And I've played in that game.
Absolutely, absolutely. You can't have any genre of role-playing game if the players aren't buying into it. I think just for whatever reason, and I couldn't begin to explain what this reason is, it's just harder to get that buy-in on certain genres, and horror is in the top two of those.
Yeah, well, you know? I think the other one would probably be romance.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Well, in both cases, you're trying to elicit an emotional response. In other genres, you're not. And that may be what people
are.
Not a strong emotional response like fear or love.
New guy challenging the host.
No, I really think you are. Yeah. I mean, I think that's the very nature of storytelling in general, is that you are always trying to elicit an emotional response from the people in the group, your audience. Mm-hmm. If you're not trying to elicit an emotional response, why are you doing it?
Yeah.
I mean, you can tell a story, I guess, but if you're telling a story that's just a dry narration, no one cares.
Telling a story is an important part of it, but if you don't have the emotional attachment and the emotional buy-in to the story, I agree with you. What is the point?
Right. Then you're writing an essay. You're not telling a story.
You might as well stop and say, okay, this is what happens.
Exactly.
This is the story.
I guess that's where we're going to go ahead and wrap this one up. I do recommend checking out Return to Oz. It's a dated movie, but I think it does a great job of illustrating a lot of the points we talked about in this show. And once again, I'm going to link to this in the show notes. I'm hoping the postcards from the Dungeon Guys are going to pick this up and maybe see if there's any storytelling opportunities there.
You're throwing down a little gauntlet there?
I am. I don't do this very often, but I am. Indeed, it has been thrown down.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yes, you're warm, Your Honor.
Keep the pan strong.
Chad?
Yes, sir.
The way you've made them suffer, your exquisite wife and mother, fills me with the urge to defecate. As for the rest of you guys, I love you just fine. Have a great week, and we will catch you next time.
See ya.
This has been a production of Fear the Boot, copyright 2010. Listeners are free to use the show in a non-commercial endeavor as long as credit is provided to feartheboot.com. You can find previous episodes and other resources at feartheboot.com. Fear the Boot is also a member of the Pulp Gamer Media Network of shows. You can find other great shows in this network at pulpgamer.com.